Are you interested in data science, but you're not quite working in it yet? In software, getting that very first job can truly be the hardest one to land. On this episode, we have Avery Smith from Data Career Jumpstart here to share his advice for getting your first data job. This is Talk Python to Me, episode 455, recorded January 18th, 2024. Welcome to Talk Python to Me, a weekly podcast on Python. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Follow me on Mastodon, where I'm at mkennedy, and follow the podcast using at talkpython, both on bostodon.org. Keep up with the show and listen to over 7 years of past episodes at talkpython.fm. We've started streaming most of our episodes live on YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel over at talkpython.fm/YouTube to get notified about upcoming shows and be part of that episode. This episode is brought to you by Sentry. Don't let those errors go unnoticed. Use Sentry like we do here at TalkPython. Sign up at talkpython.fm/Sentry. And it's brought to you by Posit Connect from the makers of Shiny. Publish, share, and deploy all of your data projects that you're creating using Python. Streamlit, Dash, Shiny, Bokeh, FastAPI, Flask, Quarto, reports, dashboards, and APIs. Posit Connect supports all of them. Try Posit Connect for free by going to talkpython.fm/posit, P-O-S-I-T. Hey folks, before we jump in and talk about data science jobs and careers, I want to tell you really quickly about some awesome news. Back in February, I gave the keynote at PyCon Philippines. It was entitled The State of Python in 2024. Well, that is now out on YouTube. The team at PyCon Philippines did a great job. The video came out great. If you want to check out the state of Python in 2024, according to me, just click on the link in the show notes to watch it over on YouTube. Now let's talk to Avery. Avery, welcome to Talk Python to Me.
Thanks so much. I'm so excited to be here and be part of the show.
I'm excited to have you here as well. You know, one of the things that people reach out to me often is, you know, how do you get into data science? How do you get into programming? How do you get into Python? You know, I've been trying, or maybe they got a degree or they took some training program, boot camp or something. And going from zero to one, I think, is the biggest career step you have to make. That next job and the one after that, it only gets to be smaller steps, not bigger steps. And it's really tough because that first big step, you're brand new at it. You have no experience, right? It's your first data science job or your first programming job. And so hopefully we can give some folks out there a little bit of a hand up to help them make that jump.
Yeah, totally. I like to show this graphic that says it's a circle, and it's a circle of text, and it says, I can't get a job because I don't have experience because, and then it restarts, I can't get a job. And that's the tricky part. Yes. It's like, how do you get a data science job when you have no data science experience? Because to get data science experience, that seems like you have to have a job as a prerequisite and vice versa. So it is very tricky. So happy to chime in on that today.
The industry can take it too far. They can take it way too far. So a few years ago, there was a really funny tweet that went around back when they called them tweets. I don't know what they're called anymore. Sebastian Ramirez, the guy who created FastAPI, saw a job posting when FastAPI was like a year and a half old. It said, you must have 4 years of experience with FastAPI to apply. And he said, hey, look, I'm the creator of FastAPI and I'm unqualified for this job. What kind of world are we living in?
Yeah, that I don't want to live in that world, but that's unfortunately where we're at. That's so tough. And it's hilarious. These job descriptions are getting out of hand, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, with AI, it's probably not going to get better. Before we could talk about that more later. But before we get into that, you know, let's just jump in with a little bit of background on you before we get to the topic. Tell us a bit about yourself. What do you do? How'd you get into Python? Things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm currently a data science consultant and also a data science instructor. I run some online programs where I teach people to become data analysts, mostly is what I'm focused on. But I also have this practice where I help companies solve data problems with different techniques. I started actually by studying chemical engineering in college in my undergraduate degree. And about a semester in, I realized, crap, I hate this. This is not for me. But I was a little of a, do you agree? Have you felt something similar?
I did a semester of chemical engineering as well. I thought, I love chemistry. I love math. Put them together. somehow they don't go together. It's like no. Ice cream and eggs or something. No, they don't go together for me at least.
Yeah, it wasn't good for me either. I was just like, oh man, I'm actually like not interested in refineries or like manufacturing, but I like you liked chemistry. I liked math. I thought this is perfect, but I quickly realized, oh man, I really like this whole programming part that I get to do in MATLAB at the time when I was an undergrad. And I was on a time crunch to get through college kind of quickly through 8 semesters. And the other issue I had was I didn't know what to do instead. It was like, I don't really want to study computer science. Part of the reason why is they kind of had this weed out course at the beginning, which you had to build Excel from scratch, basically like some sort of a spreadsheeting tool. And I was like, Wow. Why would I rebuild something that already exists that I don't even like using in the first place? I wasn't really into it. So I didn't know what to do. And luckily I was working as a lab technician at this company, the really cool company that makes these sensors that basically have the ability to smell. So Wow. They can sniff what's in the air, and it has applications for finding drugs or bombs and airports and stuff like that. And there was a data scientist on staff, and that data scientist was awesome. He was like showing me all these cool algorithms he was writing for these sensors. And then one day he got up and left, and he left the company, and we tried to hire another data scientist for like 6 months, but they were really expensive. We were a small company, and none of them really wanted to move to Utah, where I lived in Salt Lake City. And so we couldn't really find someone that would be able to do it. And so finally I was like, well, I really like this programming stuff. And I, you know, the data scientist showed me a thing or two. Maybe I could take a stab at this. And I wrote like my first machine learning algorithm. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm addicted to this. And then I never looked back and have been data science since, basically.
What a great story. Yeah, I think a lot of people fall into programming that way. And for some reason, not unexpectedly, but for some reason, a lot of people fall into Python that way as well. They're like, you know, I have a job and I got this thing I got to do. I just need a little bit more than maybe like an Excel spreadsheet or something, and put it together. And you're like, actually, this is cool. After a while, like, this is cooler than what I've been doing. Or maybe I'll make it a good part of what I do, right?
Yeah, 100%. Even just making, it was in MATLAB, which is basically engineer's version of Python, or college version of Python 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And I made like tic-tac-toe. And I remember playing tic-tac-toe against the computer. I think that's what it was. Or maybe it was Hangman. I can't remember. But I remember like the idea of like being able to play, to program games and play against the computer. And I built it. I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. I gotta do more of this.
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, I've done some MATLAB too when I was younger, and it's not that different from Python, but it's, I think one of the big differences, other than it just being like embedded in a big expensive app, is it's not a general purpose programming language, right? You wouldn't go, you know, that was fun, but let me go build this website in MATLAB, or let me create Airbnb in MATLAB, or, you know, like there's, you just don't want to sort of has this like self-prescribed limit to what you can do with it.
That's one of the coolest parts about Python, is it's really a Swiss Army knife, and you can pretty much do, I don't want to say anything, but pretty close to anything in Python, which makes it really neat. And obviously one of the huge limitations of MATLAB is, one, it costs thousands of dollars, but two, you're right, it's not going to do cybersecurity for you. It's not going to build websites. But the syntax at the end of the day was really quick. It was easy for me to transition from MATLAB to Python, because the syntax isn't all that different.
No, it's not all that different. More math focused, but pretty similar. So I think maybe that's a good place to start discussing and exploring this topic of your first data science job. And wouldn't necessarily plan on starting here, but let's start with before you even necessarily know programming language, right? Maybe you've dabbled in MATLAB, or you've dabbled in Excel, or even dabbled in, I don't know, JavaScript or something. This thing we've been talking about with MATLAB, and it applies to other areas as well, like true programming languages per se, like Julia or something like that, is how, if you invest your time into learning one of these things really well, like how broadly industry-wide of a skill, high demand skill, is that going to be, right? You learn MATLAB, you put yourself in a box. You learn a more general programming language, you kind of have more options afterwards, right?
Yeah, totally. I think like the more broad of a language you learn, the more useful you are to more industries in general. But I might take that even a step further and just say, you know, learning MATLAB, not a whole lot of companies use MATLAB, but just like landing your first data job, going from 0 to 1 is the hardest. Learning your first language 0 to 1 is the hardest as well. And then once you have that first language, the next language becomes so much easier. So one of the first things I learned was MATLAB. And then I moved to Python and that was easier. And then I learned SQL and then I learned R and then I learned JavaScript. And every time I added like a new tool to my toolkit, it was quite, not I don't want to say it was easy, but it got easier with each one. I think that's true with foreign languages as well. Once you learn one foreign language, then the third and the fourth become quite easy. At least that's what I heard. I speak kind of through 2.5 languages, but like there's people who speak like 7 and they always say like the 6th and the 7th become easier.
Yeah. You wonder how could you, because learning the first one is so hard, first foreign language. So you're like, well, how could you possibly take that on for this many languages? And it's not the same challenge each time, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think when people are considering getting into data science, they really want to consider what language they choose and where they go. Like you're coming out of a college program, you might feel like MATLAB or something like that's real popular. And yet that's because it's popular amongst professors who force their students to do it. That doesn't necessarily mean that's the broad worldview. What do you think about R? You know both.
I like R. I sometimes troll R on LinkedIn. So I guess that's another thing I should say is I post a lot on LinkedIn, kind of a LinkedIn guy. And so a lot of the times, honestly, just for jokes and kicks and giggles, I'll kind of roast R on LinkedIn just to get the trolls angry in the comments. And it's quite fun. It's quite a fun experience. But I'm not that big of a hater. I definitely think R has its place. The one thing that's really interesting about R versus Python, and obviously a big debate in the data science community, is R is kind of that does one thing really well. And it's getting a little less of that as like more packages and libraries are added to R, but R does the statistics and machine learning very well. But obviously, I don't think, once again, I don't know any websites, any like super functioning websites that are built on R. I don't know any cybersecurity that's really done via R. So I think R does what it does well. The syntax sometimes is a lot easier for people to go from Excel, which a lot of people are more familiar with in the finance or banking world, for example. The syntax is a little bit more similar to those Excel formulas than it is to Python. So I think sometimes people have a little bit more success just because, oh, this kind of feels like R formulas. Or sorry, this feels like Excel formulas. And so people really get there. I think what you're kind of alluding to is if you're going to learn one skill, you might as well learn the one skill that's applicable to the widest net, right? And so that way you're fishing in the biggest lake you possibly could versus in a smaller pond of R. I think that's worth looking at. And one of the things I actually really enjoy doing, because you mentioned, oh, you might think MATLAB's popular because that's what the professors taught you. And there's actually not a whole lot of data out there about, well, what should you learn? So I don't know if you know who Luke Bruce is. He's a data analyst YouTuber. I was going to say YouTuber on YouTube, but that's kind of redundant, on YouTube. And one of the things he's done is he's actually built this tool where he's web scraping thousands of jobs, different data jobs every week, and then displaying and analyzing the skills required for those jobs. So it's actually like a data-driven way of saying, if you want to be a data scientist, what skills should you actually be focusing on as you go, as opposed to just listening to what a professor will say, or what a LinkedIn influencer will say, or what your bootcamp will say. Like actually getting some data on, I think, is pretty neat.
That is super cool. And I'm not familiar with Luke, so we're going to dig him up and put him in the show notes for later so people can check that out.
For sure.
Do you remember any of the trends he's recently talked about?
It's datanerd.tech, I think, is the website there. I look at it mostly for data analysts because that's who I work with the most. So I know the data analyst data very well. SQL is number one at 50%. I think Python is number two at like 30%.
I think Python might have jumped it.
Well, this is for all data positions right here. So the job title you can choose.
So you can choose. Which one are you thinking I should pick here? Data?
Maybe data scientist.
Data scientist, yeah, right.
Let's see what it says.
Yeah, you're right. Wow. Oh, whoa, Python 69%. Look at that.
That's huge. So like that's even what, 20% more than SQL, which a lot of people are like, if you are going to be a data scientist, you have to know SQL.
Yeah.
If you look at the job descriptions, Python's mentioned a lot more. So if you're brand new and you're going to learn one, you might as well start with Python because that's probably the most in-demand skill that there is right now for a data scientist.
Yeah, and it's pretty easy, right? It's not like, well, why don't you just learn C++ for embedded devices? You're like, you know what? Maybe I'll pick something else to start with, right? But you know, Python's pretty easy.
I agree with you. I think Python's great. I think SQL is probably easier to learn, if I'm being honest, because really, especially for like data science stuff, there's only about like 20 commands that you need to know in SQL. But it's, once again, SQL's a lot more, there's no websites built on SQL, I'll tell you that much. So it's a lot more limited on what it can do.
It's a skill, but not the language. It's not enough on its own generally. I mean, I know you can do reports and quite a bit with it, but you know, it's like when you see these programming popularity, like what's the most popular language? Oh, look, CSS is the third most popular. Like that's not a language. That's a thing that you use with other languages, right? Like use it with all the other languages. That's why it's high up, but that doesn't mean it's high in demand exactly. It's just like table stakes, you know?
Yeah.
So you kind of got to distinguish table stakes from like picking an area, I think.
That's totally true. And really, I think Pythonistas could make the argument that there's really nothing in SQL that you couldn't do in Python. That's a little somewhat true depending on data size and stuff like that. But regardless, there is ways that you can do most of the SQL commands in Python one way or another.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be, when I first became a data scientist, I didn't even know SQL. And I was doing SQL commands, or I was doing the aggregations or the where functions or the window functions using Python. So you definitely can, if as long as your data is not like super big, then you'll totally be fine.
Right, like some kind of generator or even slices or yeah, things like that, right? List comprehensions. Set comprehensions, exactly. all that kind of stuff. Kind of like, gosh, I really wish, a little bit of a sidebar, but I wish like list comprehensions and all those things had just a few more SQL features, right? Like in a list comprehension, I say, give me this thing, maybe give me this property of this class modified, like give me the user's name uppercased, right? So that's like select. And then for thing in collection, that's like from table or whatever, right? And then you have the where clause with the if statement. But boy, wouldn't it be cool to have like a sort also in there and other things like that, you know? Oh, well.
Totally.
It's so close.
The cool thing is if you want that sort, it's what? One extra line? Like it's not too bad. So Python, I mean, I don't want to say this necessarily to make all the data scientists and SQL lovers mad. But really, Python can do a lot of the things that SQL, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure.
This portion of Talk Python to Me is brought to you by Sentry. Code breaks. It's a fact of life. With Sentry, you can fix it faster. As I've told you all before, we use Sentry on many of our apps and APIs here at Talk Python. I recently used Sentry to help me track down one of the weirdest bugs I've run into in a long time. Here's what happened. When signing up for our mailing list, it would crash under a non-common execution pass, like situations where someone was already subscribed or entered an invalid email address or something like this. The bizarre part was that our logging of that unusual condition itself was crashing. How is it possible for our log to crash? It's basically a glorified print statement. Well, Sentry to the rescue. I'm looking at the crash report right now, and I see way more information than you'd expect to find in any log statement. And because it's production, debuggers are out of the question. I see the traceback, of course, but also the browser version, client OS, server OS version, whether it's production or Q&A, the email and name of the person signing up, that's the person who actually experienced the crash, dictionaries of data on the call stack, and so much more. What was the problem? I initialized the logger with the string info for the level rather than the enumeration dot info, which was an integer-based enum. So the login statement would crash, saying that I could not use less than or equal to between strings and ints. Crazy town. But with Sentry, I captured it, fixed it, and I even helped the user who experienced that crash. Don't fly blind. Fix code faster with Sentry. Create your Sentry account now at talkpython.fm/Sentry. And if you sign up with the code TALKPYTHON, all capital, no spaces, it's good for 2 free months of Sentry's business plan, which will give you up to 20 times as many monthly events as well as other features.
Probably the biggest, it's a bit of a diversion, but the biggest similarity to that I've seen in the languages is C# link, where they actually have this. Almost all the query operators, including joins and stuff like that, built into the programming language. I'd love to see more of that kind of inspiration into Python, but you know, that's all right. It's still really good. Got a lot of cool SQL-like features, but you're right. Once you are no longer working with data in memory or you want indexes, right? Like this concept of indexes is not sufficiently well understood, I think. Every time I hit a website that takes 5 seconds to load, I'm like, somebody is not doing all the things they should be doing. I just know it.
That's totally true.
What about SQL? You know, let's talk about that for a bit, right? The SQL, the query language for databases and other things. There's ways to SQL query, not just relational databases. But you said you got away with not quite learning that, but do you think if you could start over, maybe making an effort to learn that would be really valuable? Like how important is this a thing in the beginning of your career?
The interesting thing, you know, about landing a data job is your skills only plays, I say, a third of the role. Your portfolio or the way that you portray your skills and your network, I think, are the other two thirds and are actually more important than your skills. And that's kind of how I got away with not knowing SQL and not even being, to be honest, that good at Python at the time, was because I used my network to be in the situation to get my lab technician job in the first place. And then once again, I used that same network, in this case, my coworkers, to land that first data scientist position after we couldn't hire anyone. And if I would have been applying externally for that role, chances are I wouldn't have gotten that role. I probably didn't know enough at the time to land that type of a role. But because they knew I was hardworking, they knew I wasn't like a total idiot and I really liked to learn, they took that chance on me. It paid off really well for them because at the time I was still in college. And so I wasn't getting paid that much. And I was not getting paid like a data scientist, but I was getting results like a data scientist for them. So I think it paid off for both of us. But I think if that was an external job and I applied for it, I probably didn't have enough skills for it. So I definitely think learning SQL, if you want to land a data science job, isn't a bad place to start, especially because, like I said, any programming language, I like to think of like the iceberg, kind of like the Titanic, right? There's the parts that you see, and then there's the parts that you don't even know that are there. And really, you could spend the rest of your life trying to master SQL or the rest of your life trying to learn Python. But the cool thing is a lot of the time, you only need that top little bit that's sitting at the top of the surface of the water to actually get stuff done. And so for SQL, I think that's like 20 commands, and I think you could learn it honestly, in like a month. You could learn those 20 commands pretty easily. But it worked out for me, and I didn't have to use it that much at the time until I was probably about almost 3 years into my job, and I actually had switched jobs to a bigger company. The other thing that I was working for a smaller company where we didn't have a ton of data, so we could use CSVs kind of as our database, which is not great practice. But when I eventually became a data scientist at ExxonMobil, I was going to say they didn't use Excel as a database, but they still did. But the point is they had much larger SQL databases with hundreds of thousands, actually millions of rows of data that I had to query.
Yeah, then you got to be really, you need to understand it at a much deeper level. You're like, if you do a query like this, it's going to be super slow. But if you do it like that, it can use the composite index for the sort and then blah, 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 blah. All right, then.
You're getting to the bottom of the iceberg in SQL, or maybe not the bottom, maybe like the middle chunk under the water. But there's so much to learn for both of them.
Amira, the audience asks, you know, like when you talk data job, like what kind of jobs are out there, right? So we talked both about how we did chemical engineering and then we saw like chemical factories. Like, yeah, I don't really want to work here anymore. I'm out. So thinking about like, well, what are the kind of jobs you do? I think that's really important because it's easy to get focused in on like the FANG companies. Like I want to work for like some super big tech company. I want to move to San Francisco and like that, 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 right? Like there's not just plenty of other jobs, but the opportunities, just like you described, and as well as like my first job, I worked at a company that had like 8 people and it was awesome, right? They didn't expect me to be, you know, running Kubernetes clusters and doing all sorts of crazy. They're just like, I need you to make this thing happen. Can you do like, I'm pretty new, but that thing, I can make that happen. Like, let's go, right? And I feel like the possibilities to get in, especially with these maybe more niche type of industries and companies, might even be easier for a first job.
People seem to be really obsessed with the FANG. And I don't know if that's like a societal thing or if it's just those are the companies that we use a lot. And so we're excited about them. But yeah, there's so many more data jobs outside of FANG than there are inside of FANG, even though there's quite a bit inside of FANG. And oftentimes those roles can be much more interesting and you can do a lot bigger of an impact. When I was working at this small company, VaporSense, I had so much power. I didn't even realize it. I had such a big effect on the company. I was presenting to, you know, Fortune 500 companies, and what I did really made a difference. And when it came to the point where ExxonMobil offered me to go be a data scientist for Exxon, I said, oh, I want to go work for the big company with the nice desk and the nice laptop and, you know, try something new. And when I got there, I had some pretty cool opportunities when I was at ExxonMobil, but ultimately I left pretty shortly after 2 years of being there because I just felt like a cog in the machine. And I didn't feel like I was actually making a difference. And that was really important to my work satisfaction of like, is what I'm doing being used? Is it being used to better the world? Do I feel valued? And the answer was kind of no for me when I was there. So there's definitely a trade-off between the small companies and the big companies. But also to go back to your original question, there's so many freaking roles in the data world that you're not even thinking of, that like I'm not even thinking of. I saw a new one the other day when I was helping one of my students. It was like, it wasn't data janitor, but it was something like that, where I was like, I don't even know what that role is. But there's so many roles. When I was a data scientist, VaporSense, the small company, my actual title was junior chemometrician, which basically means you're doing data science with chemistry. When I was at ExxonMobil, when I was first there, I was doing data science, but my actual title was optimization engineer. And so there's so many titles that we don't even think to search of or even to look up, but those are all data science roles. I was doing machine learning every day in both those roles, and you would maybe never guess from those titles.
Yeah, you would never guess. No, that's awesome. What machine learning libraries, frameworks were you using?
At VaporSense, once again, because it's a smaller company, I had a lot more say in what I was doing. We were building a bunch of machine, we were building classification models to basically to take the data from our sensors and sniff if something was in the air. Sometimes that was a yes, no, like, oh yes, there is ammonia in the semiconductor factory and that's bad. So that's a yes classification, kind of binary, right? Other times it was, what drug is this? Is this meth or is this heroin? One of the use cases we had was, this is binary once again, but is this recreational marijuana or medicinal marijuana? And can we tell the difference between those? So we are usually using classification models, usually built in scikit-learn in Python the majority of the time there. When I was at Exxon, we had a lot less say, like the data scientists had a lot less say in the decision-making process. We are doing a lot of multivariate linear regression with a lot of crazy hacks and transformations kind of in the meantime for one of my positions there. And then the other position I did there, we were doing a lot of AutoML using PyCarrot and letting it kind of decide what type of models to do. So,
okay. The unsupervised learning type stuff, huh?
It was awesome. It was really fun I love PyCarrot because it's like, okay, go make 25 models and tell me which one's the best. It's like, makes my job easy, I guess.
We're going to be creative with sheer numbers. That's how we're going to come up with a solution. Got it.
Exactly.
Cool. Diego is asking, like, what are some of the common stats methods, as in mathematical type stuff, you would use? So one of the things I know that some people getting into programming think is you got to be really good at math to be a programmer. I think you got to be really good at logical thinking, but you need to almost zero math to be like a web developer. You know, we're talking percents for CSS. Incrementing numbers from 1 to 2 to 2 to 3 for IDs and stuff like that. But for data science, maybe there's a little bit more. Like, where do you see that kind of background?
I like what you said. You have to think logically, but maybe the math isn't as important. And I think it's actually somewhat similar in data science. I will say you probably need a little bit more math than a web developer, but I think it's a lot less than most people think. And it's probably less about being able to do the math and maybe more about understanding the mathematical concepts. And what I mean by that is so I also have a master's degree in data analytics. A lot of master's degrees in data science and data analytics will say you need calculus and linear algebra as kind of a background for your math. And that kind of stops people. I don't want to do any calculus. I don't want to do any linear algebra. And while both those concepts do exist in data science principles, the majority of the time, the computer, Python, is doing the math. You just have to be able to interpret the results of the math and kind of know what different directions, like this is going down, an optimization problem, you know, okay, that's the derivative, you know, getting closer to zero. Like, it's really less about knowing how to do the math by hand and more just understanding what the math the computer is actually doing. So I think it's actually a lot easier than most people say. That being said, knowing how to do a derivative or taking integral, those concepts, I think, is probably underlying pretty important. But other than that, like, a lot of the times I'm doing linear regression because it's awesome. It gets the job done. A lot of the time I'm doing hypothesis testing and statistics, which you'll have to look like at a P score, nothing all that crazy. At Exxon, I had to do a lot of linear programming, but that's like the exception versus the rule. There's not a whole lot of linear programming for most data scientists. So I really don't think the math is all that hard. Now, of course, that's coming from someone who got a chemical engineering degree, who had to take all the calculus, all the linear algebra. So I did go through those courses. I haven't really done it from scratch from like a lot of my students are teachers, for example, who never took those courses in college. So I can't speak from that perspective, but a lot of my students are able to figure it out at the end of the day and transfer. So it happens.
Yeah, for sure. I think you make a good point. I think it's about knowing, okay, this formula or this algorithm or this test means this thing. It applies in this situation. It doesn't apply in that situation. Here's what you're trying to get from it, right? Like, I know I need to do a fast Fourier transform. So, and this is what it tells me when I get out the other side, but do I need to be able to sit down and recreate the integral and the calculus behind it and do that on like a home, like as a homework example, and like, give me a function and I'll do the Fourier transform and I'll actually do the symbolic integration. Like, no, you probably don't need that, right? But you need to know, I do the Fourier transform in this situation and this is why. And then I just say, call the function, do it, right?
And interpret the results. Really, that's what being a data scientist is all about is, yeah, what does the business use case, what's the desired business use case? How do I relate that use case to the data? What technique can I use to get the outcome that I need? Computer, go do it. Interpret results, present to stakeholders. That's a data scientist right there.
I think one of the challenges with that is going to be, not that it's not good, but I think it's going to be challenging because how do you learn when to use a certain statistical test or when to do some kind of funky transformation like a Fourier transform without more traditional mathematical backgrounds? And all the academics will not just go, oh, we're just going to give you like 5-minute overview and they'll help you understand it. They're like, nope, we're going to start with this axiom or this theorem from differential equations. I'm going to work up. You're like, no, I don't need that. I'm not on a 4-year plan. I'm on a 4-week plan. How do I get value from a couple of the mathematical things without being sucked into like, yeah, now I'm in differential equations at Harvard online and I don't understand how I got there.
It's such a big problem. And I'm so glad you brought this up. And I'll be vulnerable because yeah, I felt the same way. And I was like, there has to be a better way. And so about, what was it? 3 years ago, now 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, I said, oh my gosh, I'm going to solve this problem. And I'm going to start my own data science bootcamp. And so I spent about 6 months making the curriculum, making all the videos. I opened it up. I got some students in there and I ran it for about 6 months. And I looked at the results and man, we weren't getting anyone into data science jobs. And I thought, ah, what the heck am I doing wrong? I had this brilliant idea of like, we're going to be less theory, more project, more hands-on. And I realized, man, the truth is people just learn better at work. That's where you learn that whole technique that you just like, how does someone learn that? The answer is by getting experience and learning it at work. And when I looked back and I said, okay, well, we have had students get jobs. What jobs did they get? And it turns out most of them were getting like business intelligence engineer jobs or data analyst or financial analyst jobs that were a little bit below a data scientist job. And I realized, oh man, if we can just help people go from 0 to 1 and get their foot in the door, they can go from 1 to 5 much quicker at work because work is just, I don't know, it's this magical place, right? Like you said, they whatever you were working at earlier, and they're like, hey, can you do this Kubernetes thing? They just kind of throw you in the fire and you're like, figure it out. And that's somehow you do. I don't know what it is about work, but you figure it out. And that's where you learn. So that's kind of why I changed my curriculum to be more focused on, you know, okay, maybe people aren't going to become data scientists, but can we get them to 0 to 1 quickly? And then they can get paid to learn the rest of the data science stuff when they're actually in that first position.
How much do you know about what you actually want to do in the industry before you've done it as well, right? Like, you're like, oh, I thought everybody said machine learning was awesome. And I've used ChatGPT and I loved it, but it turns out actually like API is better, but I've never had a chance to build an API. So until I started, I didn't even learn that one, it was a thing, two, that it was cool or vice versa, right? Whatever. But until you get kind of in, you don't even know like actually this part is where I really am enjoying it. And so just getting that first step, that's a big deal.
100%. You don't know what you don't know until you know it. That's why, I mean, really, when it comes to, if we go back to just SQL or just Python, you could spend, and I tell people this, if you tried to master Python before you applied to a job, you'd be like 80 years old before you ever applied to a job.
Yeah.
Same with SQL, same with machine learning. The cool thing about data is we're never going to know it all. And so just learn the bare minimum to get your foot in the door. And then you have this place where you're going to get paid to learn what you want to learn eventually. If you learn, oh, I love APIs, I promise you that there's a company out there that will hire you and you can learn APIs on the job. Like that's going to happen. But that first step is so true.
There's a company out there that it doesn't know it needs APIs.
Yeah.
But you can help them. And you know they don't have huge expectations because this is the thing they just learned they needed, right?
100%.
Yeah, it's wild, right? This portion of Talk Python to Me is brought to you by Posit, the makers of Shiny, formerly RStudio, and especially Shiny for Python. Let me ask you a question. Are you building awesome things? Of course you are. You're a developer or a data scientist. That's what we do. And you should check out Posit Connect. Posit Connect is a way for you to publish, share, and deploy all the data products that you're building using Python. People ask me the same question all the time. Michael, I have some cool data science project or notebook that I built. How do I share it with my users, stakeholders, teammates? Do I need to learn FastAPI or Flask or maybe Vue or React.js? Hold on now. Those are cool technologies, and I'm sure you'd benefit from them, but maybe stay focused on the data project. Let Posit Connect handle that side of things. With Posit Connect, you can rapidly and securely deploy the things you build in Python. Streamlit, Dash, Shiny, Bokeh, FastAPI, Flask, Quarto, ports, dashboards, and APIs. Posit Connect supports all of them. And Posit Connect comes with all the bells and whistles to satisfy IT and other enterprise requirements. Make deployment the easiest step in your workflow with Posit Connect. For a limited time, you can try Posit Connect for free for 3 months by going to talkpython.fm/posit. That's talkpython.fm/POSIT. The link is in your podcast player show notes. Thank you to the team at Posit for supporting TalkPython. All right, let's talk about some career advice. I mean, I know you talked about being connected on LinkedIn pretty well, and certainly having some kind of social network is important. And a maybe, it's not that you would call it not social, but a real world network of actual human beings that you're, you know, physically know somehow.
What's that? I don't know what that is.
I know, like we gave that up back in 2020, I thought.
Yeah.
Anyway, like there was some stat that I saw somewhere that, you know, over half of the jobs are fulfilled before even becomes a job posting, right? Maybe some of the best ones. It's like, hey, who knows somebody who can do this? We need some, like your data scientist example. They quit, like, oh, we need somebody. Does anybody know a good data scientist? I don't want to just go put it out on the open job market and have to have 100 interviews and who knows what I'm going to get. Like, if you can recommend somebody, let's start there, right? So being in that group to be recommended, it's important.
It's the key. There was a really interesting survey done on LinkedIn, and they said, it was done by the same person, and Jordan Nelson, by the way. He said, how do you approach getting a job? And then the next day, he said, how did you get your last job? And 80% of people, they use what I call the spray and pray method, which basically means you go and you apply to as many jobs as you possibly can and hope for the best, cross your fingers. That was 80% of what people were doing. And then on the next poll, the next day, it was a total, I think, of what, 70% were either headhunted, recruited, or referred.
Yeah.
And so it's like the Pareto principle here where, you know, 80% of the effort is only getting you 20% of the results. And really 20% of the effort gets 80% of the results. So it's okay, we know networking and getting recruited is really important, but how do we do it? It's easier said than done. Like you said,
in the industry, how do I make friends who are, right? It's like, well, my neighbors don't do it, so I guess I'm out.
That's the tricky thing is yeah, if you're not in the industry yet, how do you get recruited into it or how do you know someone? And what I've come to learn is it actually doesn't even matter. So like, for instance, let's take your neighbor, right? Your neighbor's probably not a data scientist. Maybe you're lucky and they are, and they can refer you to a company. But what's really cool is I've learned that companies really come to trust their employees and their employees' recommendations. And so even if your neighbor, let's say, is a web developer or maybe even less technical, let's just say your recruiter is in finance, right? And if there's an opening, like a data science opening at that company, a lot of the times they will actually take their employee referrals much more seriously than any sort of cold application that they get. And so a lot of the times I've had students who just know someone that works at the company. They saw a job opening pop up. They message their friend, hey, do you know a recruiter or a hiring manager? I could talk more about this role. Could you do an internal referral for me? And they were able to land jobs that they probably wouldn't have. No, they definitely wouldn't have without that internal referral. So it is tricky. It's the old cliche. It's not what you know, it's who you know.
I think there's still plenty of ways, COVID notwithstanding. I think that these days there's plenty of ways to get those connections, right? But maybe people don't know. Like meetup.com is really good. If you live in a non-tiny city, there's many, many things going on that around data science, around Python, around other data engineering, whatever. Right. You could go to those things. They're typically even free. Often they're free with food. They even feed you, right? And make connections or regional conferences or national conferences, right? Like we probably, many people have heard of PyCon, right? There's US PyCon, there's EuroPython, and then there's, but those are the ones that are often talked about. But there's 10, 20 little smaller regional ones in the US and many more that I'm not aware of throughout the world. Probably one of those within driving distance, right? That you could go to, make connections, and just also kind of take the temperature of actually what you see on the internet versus what you see at actually talking to real people. So I'd also say just get out there.
100%. Those places have the people who probably want to hire you because they're local, right? Which is one thing that's trouble on LinkedIn. I'm big on networking on LinkedIn, but a lot of the times you're going to be networking with people who in all likelihood might never have a role that's even open to you. But the people that you're like, for instance, I'm in Utah and we have Silicon Slopes that has like a tech meetup. We have a local Python meetup chapter. We have the Big Data and Developers Conference that's free every year with tons of food. And the people who go there are people from companies around there that have the openings that you're trying to find. And they want to hire people like you who are in the area. So at least you can maybe come to the office once a week or maybe once a month or whatever, right? And so really, like you said, going to those meetups, it's tough because networking is always difficult, either online or in person. But at least in those situations, you know, hey, these are people that are tied to real companies that exist around me that do make data hires. So I have a chance.
Definitely a much higher chance than just shooting out a resume. All right, well, let's see. We talked about job hunting already. What about like applications and resumes? What are your thoughts on that?
I think once again, with the applications, the more targeted that you can make it, the better, right? So if you can really hone in on, I really want this job, I'm going to cold message 5 people at this company and see if I can get that internal referral one way or another, make a real connection with them. I think that's really key. And then with resumes are more of an art than they are a science, I feel like. Like they are so difficult to figure out. And these ATSs that are trying to match you and see if you're a good fit, I've tried a lot of them and a lot of them suck. Whoever's the data scientist behind those, we need to have a conversation with them because it's a little tricky sometimes. But one of the coolest concepts I've been introduced to recently, and I have a whole episode on my podcast about it, is A/B testing your resume. And basically the idea is a resume's job is just to get you a screener interview or like a beginner interview, basically, right? That's all an interview. Like no one's seeing a resume and then hiring you. They're always going to interview. So if you think about it, a resume's job, the only job it has is to convince someone to get on the phone and talk to you. And it's just a piece of paper. And guess what? You can put whatever you want on that piece of paper. Now, I'm not saying to lie, but I'm just saying you could theoretically make a perfect resume for whatever job you're trying to go for and send it out there and see what happens, right? But I'm not saying to do that. I'm not saying to lie. My point in saying this is that the resume is just to get you the interview. And if you're not getting interviews, something's probably wrong with your resume. And so, you know, tweak something, apply to 10 more jobs, see what happens. Tweak something, apply to 10 more jobs, see what happens. Until you finally have the right combination of skills, of experiences, of different keywords. Because a lot of the time, you're just trying to beat the ATS. And that's the sad part about it, is it's like, how do I prove to this random computer algorithm that they should talk to me on the phone? That's a hard game to beat. And there's a whole bunch of advice from all these different people. What I've come to learn is it's different for every company. It's different for every person. You kind of a numbers game until you get lucky and you figure it out.
That's good advice. I guess 2 thoughts. One is, I know that speaking specifically to anyone, but in general, women wait until they match all the requirements of a position, where a guy's like, I know 3 of those things. I'm taking a flyer. I'm sending it. I would just like to encourage the women out there to just send it as well.
I 100% agree with that. And I think if you reach 60% of the requirements, I think you have a chance. Like it's,
oh yeah.
A lot of the times those are wish lists and not actual requirements. And depending on, are you local to the area? Do you have a domain experience in this company? Like there's lots of other factors.
What about contributing to open source or having GitHub repos that can be like projects that you can show off, or what's your advice there?
I'm a huge proponent of projects in a portfolio. I think if you don't have experience with something, you create your own by building a project. And yeah, if you can do that with open source, I think you should totally do that, because I've benefited so much from open source. I have not given back as much as I should to open source development and projects. I definitely should do that. But if you can find a project that you're passionate about, that you can help with, I think you should totally do that. Even if it's not open source and you're just building a project to showcase your skills, I'm all about that. I think you can do projects that are super fun, maybe that are good for your community or good for your life. I'm a huge fan of personal projects. I've put a Fitbit on my dog before and looked at her steps. I've found the healthiest meal at McDonald's. I've looked at, like, visualized my weight over time and tried to create, like, different, like, forecasting models and stuff like that. There's so much data in our lives that you can use to make really cool projects.
Oh, absolutely. You talked about, okay, you get your first job and that's where you kind of really learn. But if you don't have your first job, you can effectively simulate that. Say, I would have gone to a job and been given a project to analyze something. I'm just interested in this thing. I've got 2 hours a day until I get a job that I can be inspired about this and just get going on it. And maybe create a website and publish your results, and it can draw more people in to actually see that, right? And start to appreciate it. They could even ask, like, all right, who's behind this cool project? Maybe I want them to come work for me. Little did they know, you're doing all this work because you got some spare time and you're trying to build up your experience and kind of self-guided study, right?
Yeah. If you can build a cool project and flip the job hunt where you're not applying for jobs, but jobs start to apply for you, you're in such a good position. And doing really cool projects can help you get there. Now, it's hard to do cool projects. It's hard to publish projects, which is one of the things that people really struggle with. For all you Python listeners out there, let me just tell you, Streamlit is absolutely amazing because it makes the deployment process so easy. It's free. It's a little tricky to deploy at first, but compared to what you used to have to do it back in the day, I'm saying back in the day, like 4 years ago, basically. But like, it was really hard to deploy something where you could send someone a URL. Hey, check out my web application, machine learning application. But Streamlit is such a cool app that makes it so easy and so intuitive to make these cool little apps that you can just put on your resume, put on your portfolio, send to recruiters. I'm such a fan of the Streamlit app. I love it.
Yeah, it's super cool. There's a couple of those, and Streamlit's definitely one of the really nice ones there. They host it. There's like some hosting behind Streamlit as well these days, right? Like, you don't even have to set up a server or anything. You just create it and put it up there.
That's what I'm saying is, like, back in the day, I used Dash a lot, and I'm still a big fan of Dash. Dash is more customizable than Streamlit and can do quite a bit more, but it's a lot more work to deploy it.
But it's more like programming.
Yeah, it is. It is more a lot programming,
the UI rather than just the behind the scenes. Yeah,
you have to do both, and you have to, like, know a little bit about, like, systems and data engineering and stuff like that. Versus Streamlit kind of abstracts that away. But yeah, back in the day, I used to make Dash web applications and deploy them on Heroku back when they had a free tier of hosting, and they've taken that away. So I don't even know what the go-to free hosting platform is nowadays. I moved most of my things to Streamlit, and it's so nice.
Yeah. We got Shiny for Python now, which is also nice.
I haven't checked that out. How is it?
I haven't done too much with it either, but Joe and the team over there are doing pretty cool stuff, like adding more, like, dynamic interactive stuff to Jupyter, like running it inside Jupyter and things. Yeah. Pretty cool.
I'll have to check it out.
I think they also do a bunch of hosting stuff over there as well, which is why it came to mind. What other advice you got for folks out there? So AI, not studying AI or learning to use AI, machine learning, but is there a benefit of trying to, you know, like, use ChatGPT to help you get this job? Or is there a danger? Like, I'm thinking, for example, like, have ChatGPT write me an awesome resume. And then the tools are like, well, we've detected this is AI generated and it's out. You know what I mean? Like, what do you see happening there?
A lot of people see AI as, like, an all or nothing tool, as in it's either you, the human, doing the work, or it's the AI doing the work. Mm. But whenever, I don't know about you, but whenever I'm using ChatGPT for anything, it's very rare it's copy and paste for me.
Yeah.
Or at least not iterative, where I'm doing multiple prompts, prompt after prompt after prompt, trying to tweak it exactly what I want. And so the way I look at ChatGPT and other Gen AI that will be coming out, it's only inevitable, is instead of looking at it, does this replace me? Does this, like, for instance, am I going to build my whole resume using ChatGPT? Can ChatGPT build, you know, take a data scientist's job and build the whole model for them? I like to see it more as like a hammer. It's like a tool for the data scientist or a tool for the job searcher to use in conjunction with your screwdriver or anything else. Yeah. It's like something to be wielded by a human, not replaced for the human, if that makes sense.
You know, it's really good for stuff like, hey, I know a regular expression will do this.
Yeah.
The last time I studied, I completely forgot what this is about. And I know it's gnarly, but if I just ask, here's an example, here's what I want, boom. And traditionally what you would end up doing is you'd be on Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
You'd be all over the internet. You'd be trying to piece it together from external information anyway. And so, you know, code is something that's a little bit more in the wheelhouse of the generative AI because it can't really make it up as much. I mean, I know it could like do something insecure and you didn't know it was or whatever, but it's not like asking for legal advice where it makes up cases that didn't exist. Like it gives you code, you put it in the runtime or the compiler and it runs or it doesn't, and the output comes like you did.
Yeah, it works or not.
Yeah, so it's pretty effective for that. But yeah, for resumes, I would be more like, let me ask it, what are the in-demand things? And if I know these three skills, what other skills should I know to get a, like you could sort of use it in an explorative way to then come up with what you might write for yourself, right? Something like this.
I find it really useful for brainstorming like action verbs on your resume bullets. Like I think it's really good at that. What's 10 different ways to say lead? So I don't say lead 5 times on my resume and I use some different action bullets. I think it's great at that. I personally, it's pretty rare that I start any Python code from scratch nowadays. I'm either starting hopefully from a template that I've already written, or I'm starting from a ChatGPT. Like this is what I kind of want to accomplish, right? Like the outline for it. Like one of the things I hate doing is I make a lot of Streamlit apps. I probably make a Streamlit app a month right now. And I hate starting from scratch with Streamlit. It's super easy to start from scratch. But I'll say, hey, ChatGPT, I want to build a Streamlit app. This is like the component I want here. This is the component I want here. This is the component I want here. And it's almost like a warm-up for me as a programmer. And it will create, it'll create something that works. It's not what I want. And I spend the next 5 hours trying to make it what I want, you know, without ChatGPT. But it kind of gives me a warm start to my programming process. So I really like it. I think it's something that everyone should use. And I think if you're thinking about getting into any sort of programming, you know, whether it's data science or web development, I think you should be a little bit less worried about it taking your job and job security. I think you should almost be more excited that, wow, the bar's never been lower to break into tech. Like this is a step up gift from the programming gods that I get to use to break into tech.
Another thing to keep in mind is I imagine a lot of people listening to this podcast are not just starting a college program, right? They're coming from possibly other experiences, other specialties. You know what's really good for job security? Knowing the intersection of two things, the intersection of chemistry and programming, the intersection of geology and programming for Exxon potentially, right? Like those things take you from a pool of 1,000 to a pool of tens. Right. And so what's awesome about that is it means two things. You don't throw away, if you got a degree in something else like biology or whatever, you don't throw away like, well, that was wasted 4 years. That's out. And it slices the pool of people who could apply for certain jobs way, way smaller. Right. Sounds like you agree.
Oh, 1,000%. I'll just tell a quick little anecdote. When I was at ExxonMobil, there's a lot of things I did not like at ExxonMobil. But this is something I really liked. Is about once a quarter, they would do a crowdsourced data science competition for the whole organization, like around the entire world. And they would say, this is a business problem we're trying to solve. You know, and at Exxon, we have data scientists all over the world and like all sorts of different teams and things like that. So I like did not know all the data scientists at Exxon. And they'd say, this is the problem we're facing. Here's the data. Go. Right?
Nice.
And yeah. I loved participating in these. It was like right up my wheelhouse of like, I really enjoy exploration and all this stuff. At the time, I was getting my master's degree, but I didn't have my master's degree. And I was competing against, so I'm just a chemical engineering grad, right? And I'm competing against people with PhDs in computer science and in data science and all these like people who have way more experience than me. And I actually won a few of these competitions.
Thank you. That's awesome.
I appreciate it. And it's not because I was a better programmer or a better data scientist. It's because I majored in chemical engineering. And I knew the business problem, the domain extremely well. And I kind of knew the programming and the data science stuff, but the combination of them made me very valuable. Like one of the best examples I have is we were looking at crude oil properties. And I remember like there was a forum where you'd like ask your questions. And one of the data scientists asked, hey, is sulfur bad? There's lots of sulfur in this. Is it bad? And like to a chemical engineer, that's like the most obvious thing. No, yes, sulfur is very bad in crude oil. That's very no. That's like such a fundamental thing to me. And to him or her, that was like groundbreaking. And so yeah, your domain can become your superpower in your career.
Yeah. And it makes it way harder for ChatGPT and other types of tools to just automate you out of a job because you bring in all these skills together, which is awesome. But it also makes it easier for you to get the job. It makes it easier for you to continue your momentum of whatever you've been up to. It's just, it's good all around.
Yeah. I think it's more fun too, because once again, like when I was trying to decide if I should study computer science, I was like, man, I don't really want to build an Excel workbook for building an Excel workbook's sake. That's yeah. still true for me today. I don't want to do data science for data science sake. I only like machine learning or data science when I'm doing it to solve a really fun problem I'm passionate about. That's yeah. where it's more fun. So if you can be excited about the domain and excited about the algorithms, I think that's a great place to be.
Absolutely agree. All right, we're getting short on time, but maybe tell us a bit about your data career jumpstart. You've referred to it a couple of times.
Yeah, I have a company called Data Career Jumpstart. I just try to do a lot of education. So the education happens on LinkedIn, happens on YouTube. And I actually forgot to mention this at the beginning, but I have my own podcast called the Data Career Podcast, where I help people land their first data job. We're about at 100 episodes. So not quite the groundwork that you've put in.
That's still a ton. That's awesome.
Yeah, we're getting there. And then, yeah, I also have a boot camp where I try to affordably help people land their first data analyst position by teaching them the skills, the networking, and the project and portfolio building that they need to do so.
Like the long version of this show?
Yeah, basically. Well, yeah, just take what we talked about today, expand on it, make it like 350 unique lessons, and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, very cool. All right. Well, we're about out of time. So maybe just every final call to action. People maybe are inspired. See Diego out in the audience said, awesome talk, very much so. What's next? It's easy to be inspired, but you got to take action.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's always fun to listen to podcasts, but you probably benefit way more from the action you take after a podcast. So for you guys who are maybe interested in a data analytics or a data science career, explore that. If you're like, yes, I'm in, you know, make a plan, make a roadmap. If you need help, I have like a webinar that will help you make a roadmap. Like what skills should you learn? How should you be networking and stuff like that? But really, probably if you're just getting started, trying to figure out what skills you should learn, like what are the top skills that you should be learning, and then learning those skills. And then not only learning those skills, but take action in learning and build some sort of a project that we talked about that you could put on a portfolio, make a Streamlit app or something like that. That's probably the best action you could possibly take. If you need any ideas, advice, feel free to check out my website, datacareerjumpstart.com, or the podcast, Data Career Podcast. Hopefully there's lots of free resources for you guys to check that out. If you've never seen Streamlit before, I have some YouTube videos about Streamlit that you guys can check out, but I love it. Just take action somehow, do something.
That's one of the huge, huge differentiators is like, you might be inspired, but you just got to start taking those steps and it becomes a snowball. So thanks for sharing all your experience and your advice. Hopefully some people out there are taking action, and yeah, I'll put everything we talked about in the show notes, of course. So thanks for being here, Avery.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You bet. Bye all.
This has been another episode of Talk Python to Me. Thank you to our sponsors. Be sure to check out what they're offering. It really helps support the show. Take some stress out of your life. Get notified immediately about errors and performance issues in your web or mobile applications with Sentry. Just visit talkpython.fm/Sentry and get started for free. And be sure to use the promo code TALKPYTHON, all one word. This episode is sponsored by Posit Connect from the makers of Shiny. Publish, share, and deploy all of your data projects that you're creating using Python. Streamlit, Dash, Shiny, Bokeh, FastAPI, Flask, Quarto, reports, dashboards, and APIs. Posit Connect supports all of them. Try Posit Connect for free by going to talkpython.fm/posit, P-O-S-I-T. Want to level up your Python? We have one of the largest catalogs of Python video courses over at TalkPython. Our content ranges from true beginners to deeply advanced topics like memory and async. And best of all, there's not a subscription in sight. Check it out for yourself at training.talkpython.fm. Be sure to subscribe to the show, open your favorite podcast app, and search for Python. We should be right at the top. You can also find the iTunes feed at /iTunes, the Google Play feed at /play, and the direct RSS feed at /RSS on talkpython.fm. We're live streaming most of our recordings these days. If you want to be part of the show and have your comments featured on the air, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at talkpython.fm/YouTube. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Now get out there and write some Python code.